This is HPR episode 2227 entitled, Fosdem 2017 H-Building and the Hallway Track, and is part of the series, Interviews. It is hosted by Ken Fallon, and is about 85 minutes long, and carries an explicit flag. The summary is, Ken interviews the projects in the H-Building, and anyone else that wants to talk.
This episode of HPR is brought to you by anhonesthost.com. Get 15% discount on all shared hosting with the offer code HPR15. That's HPR15. Better web hosting that's honest and fair at anhonesthost.com.
I'm at the Godot stand and I'm talking to
Rémi Verscheld.
And what is Godot?
So Godot is a 2D and 3D game engine, open source under the MIT license. It was open source in 2014 and has grown a lot over the last 3 years. We now have more than 300 single contributors and a core of maybe 20-25 active developers. Basically, the point of Godot is that you get a full engine, so with a full-fledged editor, where you can create a game from scratch by placing nodes in a scene tree and then extending the features using scripts. So for the scripting, we use a domain-specific language called GDScript, which is quite similar to Python in the looks, but it's implemented in C++ in the engine.
So what is a game engine exactly?
Yes, a game engine, it's quite a complex concept actually, because we have several engine things which are referred to as game engines. They are stuff like rendering engines, physics engines, which are sometimes referred to as game engines. But Godot is an all-in-one game engine, much like some proprietary engines like Unity 3D or Unreal Engine. So where you get the rendering, the input processing, the OS stuff, animation, everything is in one big editor. And you can create your game once and then export it to any platform supported by the engine using a runtime binary.
And what sort of platforms support the engine?
So Godot supports all desktop platforms you can think of. So Windows, Mac, Linux, FreeBSD, Haiku, mobile platforms, Android, iOS, Windows Phone, and HTML5 for the web.
How did it become so popular?
Sorry?
How were you able to get such broad support on all these platforms?
Actually, it's developed in C++ and OpenGL, so we can support any platform that supports OpenGL or OpenGL ES. And just for Windows phones, we use DirectX via a Google library called Angle, which can transcode to DirectX. And the engine is built in a very modular way, and the platform code is really well split. So it's quite easy to add support for a new platform. You just have to implement support for how to create an OpenGL context and how to access OS functions like input processing, getting the date, accessing files, stuff like that.
So what sort of games can you write in this thing?
So you can write any kind of game. It's really free. You have tools to make all genres. You can make 2D, 3D, strategy games, multiplayer, arcade games, RPGs, adventure games.
First-person shooters?
Yes, first-person shooters, of course.
And do you have a library of types of games where I can go and see examples of games?
Yes, on the website we have a showcase page where some of our users are sending us screenshots from their games. There are also many open source games that you can find, typically on GitHub, There's recently introduced by GitHub tag feature, so you can look for the Godot tag and see what games people have tagged.
So for a complete novice, how difficult would it be to say get something that bounces a ball?
Yes, it's quite easy. When you open the editor, it's a bit frightening. It's like Blender. It can do so many things that it's hard to understand what to do. So my advice is to start by reading the beginning of the official documentation. We have a step-by-step tutorial which goes through the basic concepts and how to make a simple Pong game.
Ah, very good, yeah.
And then I would say there are many, many video tutorials made by the community, like how to make a Flappy Bird game, how to make a space shooter, how to make a platformer game. And then you can just go through each video where they introduce a new concept each time. So when you see maybe the 10 videos, you have created yourself a full game.
Fantastic. Do you, what sort of requirements would I need in order to run this? It's a desktop application, is it?
The editor is a desktop application. It runs on all our desktop platforms. And it has very little dependencies because we tried to implement as much of the stuff ourselves. And then we rely on some libraries, but they are of course compiled in the official binaries. So Godot is distributed as one binary. You don't have to install it. It's just 10 megabytes for the whole game engine. And you can then just click it and open it and start working. Then you can also download official demos to inspect their code. Yeah.
Would it run on a Raspberry Pi?
It would run on Raspberry Pi. I haven't tested myself, but basically Pi is Linux, so it supports our X11 protocol. And maybe there's some work needed to make sure it builds on ARM, ARM for Linux. But it should be quite easy. Actually, there was already some interest in doing such ports, but we never heard back from the guys who started it. But it should be doable quite easily.
Excellent. Is there anything else coming up this year that you want to tell people about?
Yes, our current release is 2.1, which was released last summer. And our next release is going to be Godot 3.0, where we are changing lots of things, and mainly the killer feature will be a new physically based renderer, which is state-of-the-art rendering, which should concurrence or maybe be better than some of the commercial renderers that you can find in Unreal Engine or Unity 3D. So it's going to be quite awesome. It was developed thanks to a grant by Mozilla, where we received last year $24,000, which we could use then to hire full-time our main developer, which is also the engine creator. And so for the last 4 months, he has been working full-time on the engine. And the progress is mind-blowing.
Okay, excellent. Is there a company behind this, or is it a completely free project?
Yeah, it's a completely free project. It was started by two Argentinian guys. And for a short time, it was sponsored by their own company. But they left this company, and now it's back as a completely free open source project. And our legal entity is Software Freedom Conservancy.
Right next door.
Yeah, right next door.
Excellent stuff. Well, thank you very much for taking the time to do an interview, and enjoy the rest of the show.
Yes, thanks a lot.
Hi, I'm at the Software Freedom Conservancy booth, and I'm talking to
Bradley Kuhn.
Hi, Bradley. What is the Software Freedom Conservancy?
So primarily, the Software Freedom Conservancy is what's called a fiscal sponsor organization. We create a home for open source and free software projects, so they can join our organization rather than forming their own nonprofit. And the value that they get is the ability to get all the things done you need from a nonprofit that we take care of, so they can focus on software development and documentation instead of logistics.
So you're actually a charity?
Yes, we are a charity in the U.S. We're what's called a 501c3 charity in the U.S., which is sort of the gold standard of charities in the United States. And that means that we are chartered to do the public good. And the public good that we pursue is making sure that open source and free software is available and accessible to all by helping our member projects advocate about their projects, educate new developers, run conferences, make sure their trademarks and licensing are in order. Pretty much anything you can imagine a project might need, we try to help them with.
So what are the requirements in order to become part of your conservancy?
So we have an application process, and if people are out there running free software projects and think it might be a good fit for them, they can go to sfconservancy.org/apply, and there's a whole list of details about how to apply. But really, the primary requirement is your project has to be community-oriented and developed by a large, diverse group of people, individuals and companies as well, but we'd like to see a lot more individual contributions. And it, of course, needs to be under an open source and free software license.
Yep. Say, for example, Hacker Public Radio is a Creative Commons by SA license. Would that apply?
Well, we are focused on being a home for software projects. So since you're a very good service to the community for sure. But we're really focused on doing software, and part of that's because that's what our charter says. So when you become a charity, you define a charter with the regulatory body, and our charter is specifically for open source and free software projects.
So how are you funded?
So we're primarily funded by individual donations. So if people are like hearing about what we do and they think they would like to see us do more of it, they can go to sfconservancy.org/supporter and become a supporter for $120 per year or $10 US monthly to support us.
Less than the price of a cup of coffee.
You know, a lot of charities use that phrase, and I try to. Actually, what I try to do is I say, if you like to go out to dinner, just go out to dinner one less time per month, and you'll have enough money to give us money. And then people joke that I must only go to cheap restaurants, because in most cities, in the U.S. and Europe, you can't get a dinner for $10. But then I say, you sounds like you go to really fancy restaurants, because I can't go to those.
I'm too busy defending your rights.
Well, mainly because I work for a charity, and we are efficient with our dollars, and I'm happy to make a middle class lifestyle working for a charity. But obviously, we do not pay as well as the tech companies that many of our supporters work for. We are primarily funded by individual donors, and if you have a company that can sponsor, they can sponsor us too, and that's another way we get revenue. So if your company is willing to do that, that's wonderful. And also, the interesting thing about our model is that we accept earmarked donations for each of our projects. So if there's a specific one of our 30 and now growing member projects that you're really interested in, you can donate specifically to that project, and those funds are earmarked within our organization specifically to go towards that project and advance its goals specifically.
So how are you different from the Free Software Foundation?
So the Free Software Foundation is a colleague organization of ours. I also happen to be on the board of directors of the Free Software Foundation, so I care deeply about that organization. But the FSF is primarily a free software advocacy organization. So they're trying to educate about very important issues around software freedom and the future of software freedom. And Conservancy really is an organization that's doing services on the ground for the community of free software projects. We do a little bit of advocacy ourselves, and we actually collaborate some with the FSF on that advocacy that we do. Particularly around copyleft and education about copyleft licensing. But our primary goal is to take individual developers who really need to get something done, but they're focused on software development. That's what they know best. They don't know how to run an organization. They don't know how to run a conference. They don't know how to register a trademark. We take care of those things. So we're really focused on services directly for the open source and free software community.
So protection from getting sued, for instance?
That's some of the things we have to do for our projects. We do have certain amounts of liability protection for our projects when they join. Our general fact of the matter is we don't think anybody's foolish enough to sue an open source project for various reasons that I would be happy to discuss. But we do provide that protection. If anybody were ever sued by a company or something like that, we would be there to defend them.
So, what has been going on in the last year? Any cool new things?
So we've had a couple of projects join. You're here. You're probably about to talk to. Hopefully, your listeners can flip over to here. The Godot project is here with us. They're one of our new projects. It's a game engine, so you'll be talking to them soon. Yeah. They're right next to us, so they'll be your next interview, I bet. So your listeners can speed forward maybe and hear that one. And so they joined this year, and a couple other member projects joined. You can see on our website. We've been doing a lot of work for our member projects that are copylefted. So we have both projects under. We're license agnostic. We accept projects that are copyleft and non-copyleft, but the ones that are copylefted, they have asked us to do a lot of advocacy work in the area of copyleft enforcement and copyleft licensing and education and compliance activities. We've been doing a great deal of that this year. I've been speaking a lot about it and educating. I gave a keynote here at the conference at FOSDEM about that issue, and I'd encourage your listeners, after they're done listening to your show, to download a copy of the keynote I gave here about the future of copyleft and how it works, so they can learn more about that.
Super. And coming up next year, any other plans?
Well, we always have plenty of plans. We're hoping to bring in more member projects. I like to say we have a queue of projects lined all the way through the house and out the door and around the sidewalk of projects that want to join Conservancy, and we hope to grow and be able to add them. We always prioritize the needs of our current projects over the ones who are applying, but we bring the new ones in slowly. We're hoping to do that this coming year. I should also mention one of our member projects is the Outreachy program, which is a program to encourage participation in open source and free software from groups that are traditionally underrepresented in our community, particularly women and people from other ethnic minorities that are not available, that are just not diversely represented in our community. And that's a paid internship program. So those who are in those types of groups who would like to become an open source developer, they can apply for the program. It's quite competitive, but there are many spots, and they should apply.
Okay, thank you very much for that, and enjoy the rest of the show.
Thank you for interviewing. Always happy to be on Hacker Public Radio.
Hi, I'm at the BBC booth, and I'm talking to...
Hi, my name's David Buckhurst. I'm an engineering manager at the BBC, and I look after our open source initiative, which kind of an internal collective of people who are kind of very, very into open source and free software and want to make the process of the BBC releasing open source software as easy as possible.
And have you struggled with that?
Not really. I mean, most people, I think, feel that kind of because of the BBC's public remit, actually opening up the software we're building is kind of an important part of that. So it tends to be... It tends to be people trying to find time to do it more than any kind of real challenges about actually getting permission or anything to get it done.
But yes, there is that on the one hand, but there's also the argument that if they don't pay the TV license, then they shouldn't be able to get the code.
Yes. Well, I think we kind of focus for the TV license mainly on the kind of broadcast space. So I think we still see that, you know, the news website and a lot of the educational initiatives we do are kind of for everyone. So, and it just happens that the license fee is how we fund it.
So what sort of software have you available? Is it broadcast related or what?
There's so much stuff, really. I mean, so things from the microbit, which kind of is obviously a big well-known one, but also we've got things like TAL, our TV application layer, which is our foundation for all of our smart TV apps, and we made that available open source a number of years ago, to kind of just because we found it so difficult building across all these platforms, just to open it up so everyone could have that level playing field.
So if you go to your website, you've got a whole list of stuff that you've contributed to.
Yeah, I mean, I think even that isn't a complete list because our R&D department do a lot of stuff that they make available. But we try and just kind of collect it together as a catalogue so that there's kind of one place you can go and look and one point of contact.
Quite a lot of interesting stuff for me for video stuff and TV metadata, so it's right up my alley. Can we talk about the big computer? What was the motivation behind building that when we've got the Raspberry Pi and we've got all these other devices? Why would a broadcasting company waste customers' license fees in order to build this?
Yeah, I think the microbit, it kind of we found that we were missing that kind of real entry level to programming for kind of high school children. And certainly, you know, why I got into to software and programming and technology was because my school had a suite of BBC Micros. So I kind of see this as the evolutionary equivalent, but really it's targeting kind of much younger children. It's that stepping stone to kind of the Raspberry Pi. And so, for example, my four-year-old was programming on the Microbit, you know, that and now he's into the Pi. So it kind of...
it's a gateway drug.
That real kind of stepping stone for kind of young, interested software developers.
So can you describe it physically, how big it is, what it does, how we can get it working?
Yeah, it's only 1.5 by 2 inches, tiny little board, LED display. It's got a couple of buttons. It's got rotation sensors, gyros. You can start with the most basic program, just maybe programming an animation on the display, and then kind of move on to, you know, maybe games based around tilting or pressing the buttons. And then it's also got connects so that you can extend beyond the actual Microbit itself and tinker with robotics and driving electronics. So we've got some examples here of things people have built.
Can you walk me through them, and I'll take some photos later?
Okay. So this is Dave 2, which is the digital autonomous vehicle for education, which is basically a clap based robot. So you can clap, and then it moves forward. One clap to stop.
So we've got here a motor controller, and this is the bit here, is it?
That's right, that's the Microbit plugged in at the top, which controls the whole thing. So.
And then there's a break-off board to a breadboard running some... What are the two integrated circuits? They're 555 timers or something like that?
I couldn't tell you. I didn't build this one, so...
Well, you got some what looks like 555 timers, big capacitors, a lot of capacitors, and some LEDs and a transistor, and a 9-volt battery. On the bottom, we've got a little motor, and I'll take some pictures to put into the show notes right here with wobble cam. Excellent. That looks very nice. And it worked.
Yes.
Moving on.
Yeah. And so this other demo is a sequencer that we've got set up, which is just demonstrating the kind of where you can kind of take the Microbit next. So they're connected via Bluetooth, all talking to one central Microbit that's looking after the sequencer, and then playing via a Raspberry Pi through a speaker we've got here.
So let me just describe this. There's a board there with 1, 2, 3, 5 rows of 8. Microbits, and are the Microbits connected to each other, or are they just getting power from each other?
Bluetooth, they're just connected to the batteries, so yeah, that's the wires you can see,
yeah.
And then Bluetooth connected to this Microbit.
One single Microbit here on the ground.
That's actually controlling things.
And how that must be a nightmare trying to communicate all these devices together.
I tell you, setting it up has been a challenge, but actually it works surprisingly well. And once it's going, it's been pretty stable all day. So,
touch wood, right there. So the idea, I've been a little bit facetious earlier on, but I think the idea of the Microbit, and correct me if I'm wrong, was to also do TV programs and additional websites and stuff.
I mean, certainly, like the educational pack that goes with it is quite an important part of it. So, so that was sent out to the schools, and in fact, we sent a Microbit to every 11-year-old in the UK. And then that was tied into the curriculum program. So and then teachers had the support to be able to teach about it. And
how has the feedback from the teachers been?
Yeah, I mean, very positive. I mean, the kids we've spoken to absolutely love it. And as I say, my own kids are just totally switched on by it. I've really got them into the idea of programming and playing with hardware.
Is this something that's available outside of the UK, or is it just restricted? Can I order them?
So the Microbit Foundation, which is kind of a company that was a spin-off to look after the Microbit, they sell it on their website, so you can order it.
How much is it, more or less?
It's around €11 for just the Microbit on its own, but you can buy the teaching materials and the battery and things for about €15. And then there's shipping costs on top of that, so you probably have to...
Okay, very good. So any other projects that I should know about?
So we do a lot of automated testing. So we've got a project called Hive, which is basically it's our internal test lab, and we've made that all open source so that anyone can kind of go and set that up themselves and use some of the same techniques for testing. And it kind of manages a lot of the pain that's normally associated with running tests on devices. So we test on our TVs. We've got a whole wall of TVs. We've got loads of mobile devices, Android and iOS. And any developer in the BBC can just send their test to a device and run tests on it or bring back screenshots. So kind of really speeds up the kind of the development.
Are you doing any OCR on that or not?
No, we aren't. So.
Pictures come back.
Yeah, but we're kind of looking at where we go next with that. But at the moment it's all we do some kind of basic sort of screenshot comparison stuff like that. But we're kind of it's something we're going to think about next. Yeah.
Okay. Well, was there anything else I missed? Or there'll be links to the websites in the show notes, bbc.co.uk/open source.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, the best thing to do is take a look at the website, follow us on Twitter, and whenever there's a new project or anything of interest, we'll post on there. So,
excellent. Thank you very much for taking the time, and enjoy the rest of the show. Hi, I'm at the Wolf SSL booth, and I'm talking to...
Hi, my name is Chris Conlon. I'm a software engineer with Wolf SSL.
Can you tell people what Wolf SSL is real quick?
Sure, yeah. So Wolf SSL is a very lightweight, very portable SSL, TLS, and crypto implementation.
And why do I need another one when we already got OpenSSL?
Yeah, that's a great question. So we're 20 times smaller than OpenSSL, so we fit very well in resource-constrained and embedded environments. We also scale well up to desktop, server, and enterprise systems as well.
So you've been, when you say smaller, you mean not the community, but the actual physical number of bytes?
Exactly, yeah. We're 20 to 100 kilobytes is our standard build size. But we are very widely used. We have over 2 billion secured endpoints on the internet, we estimate today.
What sort of devices are those?
SSL and TLS is very horizontal, so that could be anything that connects over a network or connects to the internet. That might be automobiles, that might be smart appliances, IoT, or just normal desktop applications.
Okay, and what sort of license are you releasing this under?
So this is a dual license product. It's a GPL2 and a commercial license, similar to the license model that MySQL used.
And so I guess it's kind of popular now with the swathe of Internet of Things devices. They would really be relying on Wolf SSL to provide the end-to-end encryption, I'm guessing.
Yeah, they will. And we have lots of IoT customers right now. Lots of smart light bulbs, smart door locks, routers, lots of fun stuff like that.
What has been the major thing that, looking back at the last year, what's the major thing that has happened within the project?
Sure. So within the last year, we have a couple new products. We have an MQTT client. That's a publish subscribe technology.
What's that for?
So you have brokers and then you have subscribers. Yeah. And so one use case that we're thinking about using it for in the near future is a secure firmware update system.
Okay. And what's that?
So updating your embedded device firmware remotely and securely.
Okay, so when the inevitable happens and they're DDoSed, then you at least are able to go into somebody's home and fix the device for them.
Yeah, the device may need to update its code. It might need to update certificates. And this would just provide a mechanism to easily facilitate that.
And is after the recent attack, botnet attack using Internet of Things devices, I'm guessing that's becoming a popular thing to be able to. Can you update all the firmware on my remote light bulb, for example, or?
It would be dependent on the vendor. But this will just be a tool for them to use to make that a little easier to do.
And coming up next year, what's the plan?
So we're going to continue to grow the company, add more developers, push out some new code, continue development on our SSL, TLS, crypto. And we also have an SSH server that we're bringing up. We've also got some ports to new hardware crypto platforms in mind and new open source projects.
Is the working on a crypto really a thing that you want to invent your own crypto, or are you just re-implementing schemes that are already out there?
Yeah, so we're implementing specifications that have already been written. It's very hard to develop your own crypto solutions. And if you do that, you should be very careful. We have 20 people just working on this all day, every day. So
how do I know that your stuff is secure?
Yeah, so we've been around over 10 years. We do a lot of testing. We do a lot of static and dynamic analysis. We do a lot of unit testing. And so,
do you have anybody externally come looking at your code?
We have had several of our larger customers, security labs, go through our code and look at it more of a line-by-line analysis. And we also work with security researchers at various universities that have analyzed their code base and sometimes contribute back even changes that they find.
Okay, that's awesome. So what are you looking for here at FOSTEM? What's your goal?
Yeah, our goal is to just kind of spread the word about WolfSSL, find some cool new projects to work with, help our users use WolfSSL more effectively. And we're having fun.
Cool, excellent. Couldn't say more. Thank you very much for the interview. Enjoy the rest of the show. I'm at the Gilmore Lab stand in the Hitch building, and I'm talking to
Daniel Izquierdo.
From Viterbia.
Okay, and what is Gilmore Lab? Am I pronouncing that correctly?
Gilmore Lab is a toolchain to analyze open source communities. So basically, what we do is to retrieve information from any of the usual data sources. So you can go to Git, Gerrit, mailing list, IRC channels, Stack Overflow, Twitter, all of them. And the toolchain basically aggregates all of the information in a NoSQL database. In this case, this provides JSON documents, and those are uploaded to Elasticsearch.
Okay, so why would I want to gather information from an IRC channel and put it into Elasticsearch?
There are several approaches. So if you're a community manager, probably you are interested in engagement of your community. So who are the new developers, how good you are retaining developers, and who are those that are leaving the community? Maybe you are interested in saying today hello, but also to say we are missing you, why you left the community, right? So you want them to come back to the community. So you need data in the end to make decisions and to apply specific policies to retain those developers.
So you're going to monitor your users?
Exactly. But this is for the good.
In a nice way.
Yeah, exactly. So we try to. And this is we are working with some communities like the Linux Foundation and the Eclipse Foundation. All of the toolchain is 100% open source. The data is also their data, is not our data. So we only provide the SATA services.
I mean, you already know if you're checking into Git and typing on IRC, by the policies, it's either public or not. So I'm messing with you a little. But is this actually useful?
I think so. So we have some good customers, let's say, and there are some people using the toolchain. As far as I remember, I can say that some people from the open source group from Samsung are using the tools on their own. This is also used by some research labs around the world. And Viterbia, which is the company providing the services under this, is we also have some good, let's say, customers. So as I mentioned, we are also working with Wikimedia Foundation, Eclipse Foundation, Linux Foundation. We are also working with companies such as Red Hat. So yeah, I would say that it's quite useful for communities and community managers.
So everything is open source. What sort of licenses, or is it depending on the project, depending on the components?
There are not licenses. I mean, the license we use is GPL version 3 for the source code. It's Python, by the way. So you are more than welcome to come and send pull requests. And the data is yours. So basically what we only do in Viterbia is to build the environment, and we provide the knowledge to say, okay, this is, let's say, the data you need and the metrics you want to have. So we build the panels. But everything is open source, so you can do it by yourself, basically.
So you're offering consulting services?
Yeah, but also maintenance of the service and so on.
General kind of Red Hat-ish type of model.
Yeah,
just maintenance and support, okay.
Yeah, it's more maintenance, and then let's say we sell knowledge in the end in terms of the company.
Okay, well, what made you to, what? How did you wake up one morning and decide, yeah, this is something we want to do? Where was the need?
So we all came from the university, something like we've been researching in open source for the last 10, 15 years. And then at some time, we started to have some, let's say, more industrial-oriented needs from the companies and the people. Things like we need a new backend, or I need you guys to work on these specific needs or studies that they have, because we don't understand where our bottlenecks in the software development process are. So then we said, okay, maybe we need to try this. And then we went for Bitergia, which is the startup, and we started four and a half years ago. And then, well, we started four, we are now 12, so it's quite good.
So you might use that to see, you know, if you're having an issue getting developers are coming in, but they're dropping off after a few weeks, and where you can do improvements within your tool chain, I guess.
Oh, can you say again?
This would be giving an example. Developers, you see developers coming along, and then they do two commits, and then they go away. You can try and see that as a problem, and how you're going to, a community manager could then decide how she's going to go and fix that problem.
Yeah, you are absolutely right. But I have to say that this provides information about broader scope. So this is providing information about activity, community, and process. So in terms of activity, this is counting, let's say, potatoes, right? But then if we go for the community, we can go for which companies are working with which companies or developers interacting among them and so on. And you can say the retention and how those are being attracted and retained, and maybe they are leaving. But also in terms of process, so an example is, as far as I remember, the OpenStack community, they had this issue of they didn't know where the they had some bottlenecks in the in the code review process. So then we went for this analysis to understand who, if the problem was in the people reviewing or in the people submitting the code. So you can have the time to review or the time to submit.
Yeah. And you were able to identify that.
Yeah. So then after this, well, I don't know if they decided to go for because of these results, but they started some training process of the submitters.
Okay, very good. So what is coming up next year? Do you have any plans, any new releases? What are you looking for?
Well, first, anyone is more than welcome to come to the community. So we have an IRC channel, Metrics Grimoire, so you can go there and ask everything. So we are a small community, but quite active. As I mentioned, this is Python-based, so let's say it's quite easy to develop there and quite straightforward to develop new backends. For the next year, I don't know. But probably to keep working on Kibana. We are now migrating to Kibana 5, which was released some weeks ago. So we are basically in that process.
Okay, excellent. Anything else that I missed that you want to mention?
I love FOSDEM, so, and thank you very much for the interview.
No problem. I'm at the MySQL booth, and I'm talking to
Mark Lee.
Hi, what is MySQL?
So MySQL is an open source database, the number one open source database, both a clustered and replicated database, highly available and easy to use for pretty much the web.
But I thought MySQL stopped as a project when it got forked by somebody else.
No, it didn't stop. It's actually moved forward a great deal since we got taken over by Oracle.
So what sort of changes has occurred within the project then?
Lately, we've been focusing on replicated or clustered solutions and working with an overall clustered solution with a router transparently.
Yep.
We're working on data dictionary at the moment, a real data dictionary in the database to help scalability. And focusing a lot on things like security, scalability, performance, yeah, those kind of things, instrumentation. Those are our major focuses right now.
And what is the community, what's the license that it's released under?
It's under GPL still.
GPL.
Yeah, we haven't changed that at all. The model of MySQL is the same as it was in MySQL AB, pretty much.
And the support options, it's owned by Oracle. Oracle have their own database. How does that sit together?
The way we see it, like I said earlier, we are largest in the web, where Oracle really doesn't sit that much. They sit in the enterprise. So we continue to be in the same model that we always were. We sell our enterprise subscriptions, a yearly subscription. That provides support and monitoring tools and security and some scalability tools or plugins into the server itself. And that's the way that we see it. We'll continue to work to be the number one web database.
So two different spaces.
Entirely two different spaces. We focus on web, and Oracle focuses on the big enterprise side.
That said, the name Oracle probably ain't going to hurt you either.
Pardon?
Having the name Oracle Inc. going to hurt you either going in?
It doesn't hurt us. It's actually been a very good thing for us in large enterprise spaces as well. I mean, it's funny. In large enterprises, they use Oracle a lot, but they also use MySQL a lot. I mean, there's a lot of departmental little applications and things like that where MySQL is still used, and definitely on the web of those enterprises as well. So,
what's any big changes that were happening last year that you want to tell us about? Keystones, milestones?
Last year we released 5.7. This year we've gone and on to release what we call group replication, which is a virtually synchronous replicated cluster of systems in 5.7 itself.
What does a virtually synchronous cluster of servers mean?
So it's not actually fully synchronous replication. The system agrees on changes, so that it's all pushed into a Paxos-based group communication system. So they all agree on the changes, they get replicated and asynchronously applied, but they will get applied because the agreement of the protocol basically ensures that they will be applied in properly.
So there's no risk of loss of data in this process?
There is no risk. Yeah.
That's always good when talking about databases. I like that as a database.
Yeah, we like that as well in databases too.
Coming up next year, what's the plans? Anything cool happening?
So at the moment, we're focused on 8.0, the next big version of the server. Like I said earlier, we're doing the a transactional data dictionary, which is probably something that's been most requested with MySQL, the way that we manage information on objects, tables, and alike has been pretty poor up to now. But with the data dictionary, it's much better. It's fully managed in ODB in a transactional storage engine, and not stored in two places. So that's probably the largest piece of work that we're working on right now. It's a massive project.
Were you a MySQL developer before Oracle took you over?
I have been with MySQL AB through Sun and Oracle, so I've been with the company for 11 and a half years now.
How have you found the transition?
I found it very positive from our perspective. We have had massive investment from Oracle. So the amount of QA and the focus on QA and having a stable product and a good product has been something that Oracle have pushed us very hard on, which is something that is actually very different to MySQL AB. We weren't as thorough in the QA processes, where Oracle believes that we should be as solid as possible and as secure as possible. So those things have been hugely positive. They've grown all of our teams. They continue to push us to make a better product. So it's been very positive for us.
Anything else that I missed that you want to get across?
No, I don't think so.
Okay, cool. Enjoy the rest of Austin. And I'm talking to?
Andrew Shadura.
And what's your project?
The project is called Kalitea, or Kalitea, depending on what language is your first language, basically. It's a Greek word which means the best view. And this project has started as a fork of a previously free software project, when the original authors decided they don't want to keep it fully free software.
What was that project?
It was called Rodcode. It still exists, and they came back to the free software model, but they decided to go for open core model, which is something we don't quite like. So it's not likely that the project will merge back at this moment. But with help of Free Soft Freedom Conservancy, we made a fork of the project and continue to develop it in as a community.
Okay. And what exactly does the project do?
The project aims to develop a free software collaboration hub, basically. There's lots of software. There's GitLab, GOGS, and other things. Basically, it's a GitHub you can install on your own server. And unlike many other projects out there. This project supports both Git and Mercurial, which is basically how it started. The original author decided to write Mercurial repository server, and then he added the Git support. And we support pull request workflow. We have some nice code review tools. Unfortunately, there's no backtracker yet, because this is not an easy task to design a backtracker from scratch in a very good way. So we decided that we probably shouldn't do this at this moment.
And what's been happening in the last year, and what are you going to be doing this year coming forward?
Well, as this project is based on quite an old code base, I think the original project started in 2007 or something like that. We have quite lots of code we need to clean up and things to improve. So we've been doing lots of cleanup stuff. There was an initiative to port the code base from Pylons, which is the web framework we've been using for quite some time, to TurboGears, which is it's another web framework which is being developed unlike Pylons. Pylons has been deprecated by the original authors. They now develop. It's called Pyramid. But Pyramid, it doesn't have there's no easy way to migrate from Pylons to Pyramid. And TurboGears maintains some compatibility with Pylons, so it may be easier to migrate there, and the upstream offered us some support in this migration process. So there's a group of people working on that. And there's also been an initiative which I started, in fact, to migrate the project to the front end to Bootstrap, because Bootstrap is a CSS and JavaScript library. Because we've been using lots of custom CSS and Yahoo UI toolkit for JavaScript, and we've been trying to migrate from that for some time. And you know, our custom JavaScripts, they look very like 2000 something, not modern enough, not like GitHub at all. So I started this something. I tried to do some work, but one person was not enough for this, and then another guy joined and started it basically from scratch, incorporating bits of my work, and we've done some progress, quite some progress, and I hope we can finish the migration in couple of months.
Fantastic. Where can somebody get your project now? Where can I get the code?
Well, if you go to kalitiahcm.org, there's a Mercurial repository there. You can clone it, and there's a documentation on how to install it. Unfortunately, there are no packages in distributions yet. I tried to package it for Debian, but because we incorporate lots of code from different projects, the copyright compliance is not an easy job, because even though we worked with Software Freedom Conservancy to be fully GPL3 compliant, unlike the original project was, Bradley Kuhn and other guys, me included, we made quite a lot of work to document all code we have and fully comply with GPL3. Debian, which I'm also part of, has some slightly stricter requirements, and I was not able to fulfill them yet. I'm still working on
work
that.
Work in progress. Yeah.
Okay. Cool. And anything else that we missed?
I don't. If you're someone who knows how to code in Python and knows something about web frameworks, you're welcome to join the project.
Okay, you heard it here, folks. Thank you very much for taking the time, and enjoy the rest of the show.
Thank you.
I'm talking to
Reinhard Lutz.
What is what project are you here promoting?
Well, we are promoting a project very easy to explain. The project covers the fundamental rights people have in the internet. We associated a new club or association located in Graz, that's Austria, and the name of all is World Privacy and Identity Association, in short WPIA.
And what's the purpose of this organization?
But the purpose is to set up and operate a trustful service provider. We are in a phase to set up three legal entities. The first entity is our association, which is done. We are registered at the official registration office in Steiermark, Austria. We have several registration numbers at the Data Protection Court. We have a DUNCE number and so on. The second and the third legal entities are just in the beginning. One will operate and run the certificate authority, and the other one will be founded as a cooperative. The idea of cooperatives is not new. The UN has made it an immaterial I forgot the word. Immaterielles Kulturgut.
Cultural importance.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah. Okay, we'll go with that.
Yeah, we go with that. Okay. So we will set up a cooperative, and the cooperative is open to all kind of organizations. The basis of all, of the association, the cooperative, and the incorporation is the respect to the human rights in its full extent. And we think that, for example, if you deploy certificates, you have to manage trust. The basis of all is trust, and trust is one of the basics in human rights. If you have no trust, or if you lose trust and so on, you may lose your rights, and that is not our target. Our target is really to allow people to organize their rights in a digital environment.
Okay.
How does that... So you're an umbrella organization for certificate authorities. So
just for one.
Just for one.
We're just setting up three legal entities.
Yeah.
One is an association that is done. This work is done. The second one is an operating incorporation. That's the CA, a certificate authority. It's our certificate authority.
Yeah.
And the third one is a cooperative. The certificate authority will get its customers only through the pipe of the association,
yeah,
or the pipe of the cooperative. So it's not on the market to look for customers or to sell certificates. No. The members of the association and the cooperative have the right to get as many certificates as they need, and the members of the association will not pay money, just a membership fee, and the same will happen with the cooperative.
Yeah.
The cooperative will pay a membership fee, which is very low cost, and they at least will pay the cost to operate a certificate authority.
Okay.
So, and the when our final setup is done, after an audit, and we will start with an audit on the first day we deploy certificates, there is no test phase, no phase to show that that we are able to demonstrate we can do it. No, we will start with an audit on the first day, and we think that audit is successfully passed 1 day, 1 year later. We will start in this year summer. So the audit should be passed in 2018.
Okay.
And then do you think that you will have browser support, or are you...
Immediately, because if we are a member of the CAP Forum, that's some kind of an association between browsers and CAs.
Yeah.
If we are a member, then we enter the trusts of the browsers more or less automatically.
Okay, very good.
That's the procedure. Yeah, okay.
And how do people help, or how do people get involved in the project?
At any time. They have possibilities to deploy, for example, development and software. They can help in documentation. They can help in making propaganda for us. For example, showing and demonstrate on workshops how the software works. I have to say, the software is used in two different areas. The one area is our own certificate authority.
Yes.
It runs the software, and the result are certificates which we deploy. The second and totally different use case is that everyone may download the software and use it, for example, to set up its own internal PKI. So you see, an internal PKI is run, for example, by every government in this world. And the biggest one is the US administration. If you see Europe, the biggest internal PKI is run by the administration of the Federal Republic of Germany.
Yeah.
And so they can use our software. The government will not do it, they have their own capabilities, but the market, there are so many organizations who have problems in this, they may use our software freely.
Okay, very good.
That's it, yes.
Excellent. Was there anything else we missed, or have we covered everything?
No, that's all I have to say for the day. And what I wish here at Forstum to get new members into our association, and everybody is welcome.
Excellent. I'll have links and everything in the show notes. Thank you very much, and enjoy the rest of the day.
Okay, thank you.
Hi, I'm at the XMPB booth, and I'm talking to
Sam Whitehead.
Hi, Sam. First of all, tell everybody who didn't listen to the shows that we've done before what XMPP is.
Yeah, so XMPP is an extensible framework for communicating between any two arbitrary nodes on the internet. It's mostly used for instant messaging, but also in a whole suite of other things, including logging and data synchronization and all sorts of different uses.
And how secure is it as a messaging system?
Well, like anything, it's sort of as secure as you make it. But one of the kind of primary, one of the main goals of XMPP is, of course, to be secure, especially in the instant messaging field. So by default, almost everything is encrypted, both with your normal client to server TLS, like you would expect with an HTTP connection. But there's also the ability to do full end-to-end encryption between two nodes talking to a server can also encrypt between themselves so that the server doesn't know what's going on. Aside from encryption, things like authentication use standard protocols like SASL, the secure authentication and security layer, to make sure data stays safe and passwords aren't sent over the wire in an unsafe way. And so it definitely security is one of the primary goals.
So this isn't really a product like, I don't know, Firefox. This is more like HTTP, rather.
Right, absolutely. It is, yeah. XMPP, a lot of people use the name as if they were talking about a product, which is unfortunate because I think that confuses people. But it's the Extensible Messaging and Presence Protocol. And it really is just something to build your product on, not something to sell as a product itself or to add to market as a product itself, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. Is there like a foundation behind it? Is that?
There is. The standard is mostly maintained by the core XMPP specifications are maintained by the IETF, the Internet Engineering Task Force. But the X in XMPP is weirdly for extensible. which and the extensions and all of the kind of the development on the protocol is handled by the XSF, the XMPP Standards Foundation. And most of the people here at POSTIM today are members or affiliated with the XSF.
I must say, now that I'm reading more stuff, I'm seeing XMPP as a protocol being used a lot more. Is that because of the Internet of Things devices, or is that because of development methodologies have changed?
Yeah, definitely. That's definitely part of it. The IoT or Internet of Things crowd has definitely become one of our biggest proponents recently. We've had a lot of companies building IoT devices that use XMPP for communication. And one of the sort of nice things about the protocol is it's all streamed, and you end up with it streamed over persistent connections, which is really good for small devices that need to save battery, where you don't want to be having to create a turn your wireless radio on and create a new connection and then send some data and then get some back and then turn it off and then have to do it every single time someone wants to send data. With something like XMPP, you can create a TCP connection and then leave it, and your radio, say, can go off when nothing's being transmitted, and you don't have the overhead of, and then come back on only when it needs to receive data, and you don't have the overhead of all of the extra tail time creating a TCP connection. You just can keep your old one. So it is popular.
Yeah, that's interesting. Is there a way to explain how that would actually work in practice?
Pardon me. Yeah, that did get a little technical. I apologize for that.
No, we're fine with technical. It's just
one of the actually big common misconception about XMPP is people all the time say, "Oh, XMPP is terrible on mobile phones because you have to always keep that TCP connection, so it's very bad for bandwidth." The thing about mobile phones, though, is the radio, an LTE radio has two states and a power saving mode, which can operate in both states. And when you connect to a tower, you make a TCP connection. You have to turn the radio on, and there's a long tail time between where the radio has to turn on, and that's using power, and then you have to create the TCP connection. But once that connection's created, the machines aren't talking to each other unless data is being sent. You just have a TCP, I forget what the TCP spec calls it, a connection ID or something, and you know to contact this machine when you want to send data. So if no data is being sent, the radio can go off, it can be asleep, and then when you're ready to send data, you can wake it up and send data over that same TCP connection without having all the extra tail time of creating and all the time creating a new one. Similarly, at least on mobile phones, when data needs to be sent to the mobile phone in the low power state, you can't actually use a TCP connection. You receive I think it's called a paging message from the mobile tower, and the paging message just says, "Wake up, I have some data I need to send you," and then you can put the radio into the high power state and start sending data over that TCP, or receiving data over that TCP connection. So having that persistent connection saves a massive amount of battery over, say, something like HTTP, where you can have a persistent TCP connection, but maybe you do, maybe you don't. XMPP is also asynchronous, which is very nice. You don't have to have the problem of, similarly with HTTP, say, since that's the protocol everyone knows, I kind of used that as an example, where it's very synchronous. You send a request, then you wait for a response, and there's some extensions to do pipelining, but you never quite know, and different things support different, maybe they support it, maybe they don't. XMPP is always asynchronous, so you send what you want, and then you wait, and you might get a response back, you might get them back in a different order. So it's sort of like asynchronous programming, and it adds challenges, it adds a bit of complexity, but it also means on something like a mobile connection, you don't have to be waiting for a response before you can send another request. It's mostly fully pipelined that you can.
So I'm assuming that from a connection point of view, if you made a TCP connection here in Brussels, and you're on the train and you have nothing to send, and you arrive in Antwerp on a different cell network, is that connection still going to be open? That's still TCP?
That's a great question. I think, don't quote me on this, I know it's on the internet now and I've said it forever, but I don't believe that's handled by TCP normally, because you've changed IPs, so it can't know that it's the other end can't know to send back. But in XMPP land anyways, we have a protocol that's widely implemented called stream management. And what stream management does is it does that, but at the application, the XMPP layer, the application protocol layer. So when you first make your connection and you do your authentication or connect your server, it receives a stream ID for this current connection it's making. And if you resume within whatever your server's timeout is set at, if you swap mobile networks, you go from a cell to your Wi-Fi connection at home, say, when it reconnects, makes perhaps a new TCP connection because you have a new IP, connects back to your server and says, I have this stream ID, resume where we left off, which means it can sort of resume almost instantly and not have to go through the full handshake and do the and negotiate all the or negotiate the stream state or whatever the case may be, whatever it's
like. I'm assuming actually if you arrive in Antwerp on the same mobile operator at least, then the connection might survive. But that would be a real low level thing anyway. Okay, anything cool going to be happening this year with the protocol?
Well, I'm particularly excited about, we've just this past year released the 2016 XMPP compliance suites, which are sort of a, not really a technical thing, just a document that says, here are sort of the recommended extensions and recommended way to configure an XMPP server for a modern kind of for a modern chat experience, for instance, also for other things, but I tend to focus on the instant messaging side of things. And we're just about to release the 2017 suites, which take it a little bit further and kind of refine some of our previous choices and some of our previous recommendations. And I'm really looking forward to getting those through and making them kind of official recommendations of the XMPP Standards Foundation.
And how is, I know this because we've spoken in previous times, but this has been an ongoing effort from the XM, from you guys basically. How has the feedback been from the vendors to that process? Have they complied? Have they fixed stuff? Have they?
We've actually seen it's been great. The compliance suites we kind of stopped doing for a while. I think the last ones were in 2010 or 2009, and we just picked them up again this past year for 2016. And already we've had lots and lots of people come forward, and fix things and ask how they can best implement certain things to become compliant. Daniel Gulsh, the author of Conversations, a popular client for Android, wrote a little script that tests servers for compliance, and he's been generating a large table of kind of, you know, red green what has what features and what is compliant and is not, and that especially having that visualization of here's exactly this is your server that does or does not do things has really we've had all sorts of people on that list reach out and say, yeah, this is great, what can I do to fix this?
I know it's broken, how do I fix it?
Yeah, or what can I do to make my user's battery life better or make my my user's lives better? And so that's been really nice, and I hope that continues.
Anything else that we should know about?
Nothing off the top of my head, but definitely check us out, xmpp.org, if you're a protocol developer or a technical person. Or if you're not, there's many XMPP providers. You can go download Conversations or Swift or any of the many clients and connect to a server and see if it works for you and see what you do with it.
Excellent. Thank you very much.
My name is Brian Bouters.
And what is the Pulp Project?
The Pulp Project is an open source software project for dealing and managing repositories and content. So content is things like Puppet modules or RPM packages, Python packages, yeah. Docker containers, or
stuff that you want to organize.
Yeah, software. Mainly it helps to consume, organize, and deliver software of various kinds.
Okay. And what sort of license is it and who uses it?
Yeah, it's licensed as GPL. And
which version?
V2, if I remember. And a lot of different people use it. A lot of universities and businesses use it. Mainly people who want to deliver software to a bunch of users. So it's not really for end users.
So it's like I've got machines that I want to control and I want to push some stuff down. Is that?
Yeah, exactly. So you'll have like a pulp server and you can use that to fetch content from other sources. So for instance, with Python, you can fetch packages from PyPy and you can host those packages on premise or in the cloud. And then you can have your machine subscribe to your server, your pulp server, instead of subscribing to PyPy. It also allows you to upload your own packages, and so you can create mixtures of content between publicly available or privately available.
So I actually have a very, I've had a use case for this exact thing where I was working in a banking environment that was physically firewalled from, I mean, physically no network connection between the outside and the inside and sneakernet coming in. So this would be an ideal solution for that.
Yeah, exactly. And it also supports the ability to export content onto disk, walk it over to another machine, and then import it again.
Yeah. And then do you also deal with the problem where I specifically, for this one dude, he's built everything, and he requires this old version of this particular library that's not available anywhere, but I can put it up on this repo?
Yeah, absolutely. So Pulp is very good at managing and storing previous versions of content, and so you can make available older versions through a separate repository and have just some subset or a single user subscribe to that.
So how does that work on the client? Is it a pull thing or is it a push thing?
We have from the client, it's a pull model, and we make the repositories available, and the clients subscribe to them, and then they do their normal update process. Pulp, in right now, our main line is Pulp version 2, and we also support for some of our content types, like RPM, to actually manage the repos that the end clients are subscribed to and trigger updates.
Okay. So does this interface with YUM or DNF, or do I...
Yes, it does. So for, you know, all the content types have different kinds of clients, and so the feature set varies from here to there. But for talking YUM and DNF specifically, we have a YUM plugin, which allows an end server to report its packages, for instance, up to the pulp server, which is very useful in cases where, say, you have a security update that has come out, and you want to know what machines need to be updated. We can help you answer that question.
So I do need a specific Pulp client running on my machine, do I?
It's a generic YUM plugin that works with YUM. We do not...
What if I'm running Debian?
We are working on our Debian support, and we're looking for some community contributions to help support that effort also.
Okay, cool. So I would just use my... Ideally, I would use my existing package manager and point to your server and then pull down what I need.
Yeah, that's exactly the idea. We don't want to be in the business of, you know, writing our own client managers. We want to be the server primarily. And in Pulp 3, we actually only want to be the server. We want to let the configuration management tools like you know, Puppet or Ansible or things like that do all of that. Our core competency is in managing the bits and making them available to all the right places.
Okay, cool. So what has the last year been like?
The last year has been a real year of growth for the Pulp community. We've gotten some pretty exciting new upstream users and developers. We've gotten a real focus towards kind of ending the Pulp 2 line. Right now, we just released Pulp 2.12. We moved to a time-based release model, which lets us release more more frequently. And we've had a big improvement in our QA process with an automated test suite. That's its own separate project called Pulp Smash, which is written by some very smart people.
Yeah.
And looking forward, well, actually already, we're in the past year, certainly the past couple of months, switching to Pulp 3 and developing Pulp 3, which will be significantly different because currently on Pulp 2 we use Mongo, and in Pulp 3 we'll be switching to Postgres.
Very good. Why the change from a, you know, NoSQL database down to actual SQL database?
Yep, so our data is highly relational, and so it makes sense for us to be using a relational database. We really require all data to be perfect, and we don't want to lose a single record. And so we just cannot afford to have any data quality problems at all.
Yeah.
So the way that our application is written today, we're not in a good position to guarantee that perfectly. We do a great job of it, but mainly in some extreme circumstances, particularly in the area of like failover it can be challenging. So we're looking forward to switching to Postgres.
And coming up in, so that's what you're doing now next year?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's really our big focus, is switching to that. So we're looking for beta testers and contributors and feedback in terms of how to do that.
Cool. Sounds like a good project. Thank you very much for taking the time.
Thank you very much.
Cool.
Hi, who are you?
I'm Robin Edgar. I'm part of Team Content. We're looking for speakers for SHA 2017. We have in the current call for papers...
Hold it right there.
Am I going too
what
fast?
What is SHA 2017?
SHA 2017 is the follow-up conference for hackers. It's a hacker camp which lasts for a week. We do it once every 4 years in the Netherlands. This one's by Amsterdam. And it's the follow-up of OHM 2014.
Which we covered 4 years ago,
exactly.
Actually. And so when we talk about camping, we're talking about actual physical camping, people with tents and boats this year, I heard.
Exactly. We're by the water and it will be tents. There are more civil facilities pretty close by, if you are so inclined.
I have indeed.
But, but the fun is that, you know, the activities last well into the night if you want to. And if you don't want to, you go to sleep, you wake up, and there's always stuff happening. So it's much broader than just software or hacking. It's also guys doing food hacking. There's usually metallurgists, there's fire-breathing
art,
people.
Lots of art.
Lots of art. It's way broader than just computers and ICT.
And very, the pace is a lot slower. There's people have more time to chat.
Yep.
What happens here in 5 minutes, because you got to rush, you got to get to something else. People sit down, you have a beer. It's a cool thing to be.
Yeah, absolutely. We have 5 days with which to be together. So that makes a huge difference. It's really a bit more in depth and getting to know the people and the opportunity to meet, you know, sometimes your heroes, sometimes the people you completely don't agree with. But, you know, you have a neutral ground to chat with.
Absolutely. And there is fiber coming out to the wazoo.
Oh, yeah. We've absolutely got a lot of fiber. And it's redundant this time. So if someone puts an axe in it this year, we'll keep trucking.
Absolutely. So now go back to what you're actually asking for. Call for papers?
Yeah, that's right. At sha2017.org/CFP.
Yep.
We're looking for more interesting speakers. We have around 138 people signed up already.
Yep.
Some really interesting stuff. And beginning of April, we'll start evaluating the entries. So, you know, we're looking for anything that's kooky, crazy, fun, hackers, you know, anything that's interesting, ethical, moral, technical, anything that you feel will interest this crowd of very diverse crowd of people.
Yeah, my type of people. Cool, lovely stuff.
Nice to meet you, Ken.
Thank you very much again.
Thank you too.
Hi, my name is Carol Chen. I'm the community manager for ManageIQ.
What is ManageIQ?
ManageIQ, in a brief form, is a cloud management platform. And it's best used when you have like a hybrid complex system or environment with different clouds, both public and private. Anything from Google Cloud to OpenStack to, we're also adding like container management because containers are so popular nowadays. Through OpenShift, that's container management with ManageIQ.
So it's like an abstraction layer?
Yes, it's like a meta manager of sorts that sits on top of the different systems and managers and provides like a single interface and dashboard so you can see everything, what's going on. You can deploy VMs from the different providers that you have hooked up to the ManageIQ system. You can generate reports, usage data, see if there's something going wrong, you can, you know, fix it really quickly because everything is visually very well presented.
But if you wanted to, can you migrate machines from one service to another?
Yes, or is that... there is possibility. You can write certain automation scripts that, you know, check for certain conditions and make that happen.
So you could run your own services internally and then you get slash, you know, the old slash dotted and Twitter, I suppose.
Yeah, that, you're right.
You are trending on Twitter and then you can move everything over to AWS.
Right.
Like if do you support AWS?
Yes, we do.
Okay.
I'm not sure about the extent of the support because there are some that's more supported than others.
But you can
rent-in services.
Right.
And who's behind this project?
Red Hat is the supporting managed IQ.
Yeah.
The Red Hat product called CloudForms is the downstream version of managed IQ. Yes. Yeah. Okay, so managed IQ is upstream. It's open source. It's open for contributions.
Yes.
It's written in Ruby on Rails. So you know we have a lot of great Ruby engineers with us and. So it's a really active community, and we welcome people to learn more about it from our website, manchaiku.org. And,
what license is it under?
Sorry?
What's the license?
Apache.
Apache.
Yes. It used to be dual license. I think it was MIT and Apache, but just last February, it's now Apache 2.0.
Okay. Yeah. Very good. So what have you been doing with the project last year?
I actually just joined Red Hat last year, and so
I'm getting, samples,
so. Okay. so I just got to learn about the project myself, and we have been trying to get more awareness around the project because I think people might know CloudForms and not ManageIQ so much, and so we have been attending these open source conferences to let people know, hey, this is really powerful. Tool that you can just use it for yourself if you have like a some kind of a hybrid system that you know needs a bit more control over, so you don't have to be big enterprise to make use of it because it's free and open source, so it's available for everyone.
And what's the plans for the coming year then?
More events, more. I've been traveling quite a bit for this, which you know I'm really happy to get paid for what I love doing, which is you know talking about ManageIQ and traveling. So, and also we are having more additional providers. We are working with Ansible. Yeah, so there's Ansible integration coming up very soon.
Ansible's a Red Hat project
now. It is. But the thing is, also a lot of people use Ansible, whether or not. And previously, for some of the automation tasks in ManageIQ, you have to know Ruby code to be able to run write some of the scripts. But with Ansible, you can take the playbooks. Exactly, which makes it so
takes
so,
away the pain of making
tea. Right, because some people say, I'm not a programmer. I don't want to sit down and write code just for certain things. Yeah. So now it kind of makes it easier for that.
Okay, fantastic. Yeah. Anything else that we missed or you want to bring to our attention? Any events that are coming up that you can announce that people can miss?
Well, I will be at FOSS Asia, which is in Singapore next month.
Super.
Yes, and we will also be at Red Hat Summit. I think we are also attending OpenStack Summit in Boston, which is the one coming up. Oh, KubeCon in Berlin.
Yeah.
Is it Berlin? KubeCon in Berlin. So we'll have probably some kind of demos at each of these events.
Yeah.
And I think just go to ManageIQ.org and click on community where they should have that will be the updated event list because right now my mind is a
that's
bit
a good
blank
thing.
So I may have said all the events and dates wrong, I don't know.
Yeah, better check on the website.
Yes,
don't go booking tickets, folks.
Yeah. right, check it before you book it.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Well, thanks very much for talking to us
and
enjoy the rest of the show.
You too, thank you.
You've been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by an HBR listener like yourself. If you ever thought of recording a podcast, then click on our contribute link to find out how easy it really is. Hacker Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club and is part of the binary revolution at binrev.com. If you have comments on today's show, please email the host directly, leave a comment on the website, or record a follow-up episode yourself. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Share Alike 3.0 license.